Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have in our studio today with us a very special guest, Dr. Frank Tipler, a professor of mathematical physics at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. We're really privileged to have you on the show with us today, Dr. Tipler.
Thank you, Casey. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, I'd like you to give just a brief introduction of who Dr. Tipler is and his very impressive academic credentials. Many of our ID the Future listeners may have heard of him because of his work on cosmic fine-tuning. He's the author of the Oxford University Press book, The Cosmological Anthropic Principle. His academic pedigree is quite impressive. He got his undergraduate degree from MIT in physics, his PhD in physics from the University of Maryland. Let's also talk about his postdoctoral work, which I think is very interesting. He did his postdoctoral work at the University of California at Berkeley, as well as Oxford, and he worked under four very distinguished scientists whose intellectual ancestry, so to speak, is, I think, worth noting. He did a postdoc under John Wheeler, who, of course, is a very famous physicist who himself was a postdoc under Niels Bohr. Prior to Wheeler, he was a postdoc under Dennis Sciama, who was a student of Paul Dirac and advised Stephen Hawking. He was also a postdoc under Ray Sachs, who was a postdoc of Peter Bergman, who was a postdoc of Albert Einstein. So we like to think of Dr. Tipler as a direct intellectual descendant of Albert Einstein. And I think as our listeners will hear in this podcast, he would be quite honored by that kind of a remark. And also, he was a postdoc under Abraham Taub, who was a postdoc of John von Neumann, who, of course, had some ideas that were very influential in ID thinking. So, Dr. Tipler, we are very, very thankful and grateful to have you with us today on the show.
Thank you, Casey. A pleasure to be here.
Well, I'd like to give our listeners a little taste of the talk that you're going to give today at Discovery Institute. And the title of that talk, of course, is Einstein versus Darwin, Can They Both Be Right? And I think this is a very clever way of pitting these two scientifically great minds against each other. But of course, many people have been asking us, well, how can you put them against one another? How are they different? What was this fundamental difference? And why is that of interest to folks who are talking about the debate over origins, over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design? So maybe my first question is going to be, how were Einstein and Darwin different from one another? And why does this make for an interesting basis for your talk?
Well, I actually say it in the talk, it's much stronger. Can both be right? One has to be wrong. Only one can be right. And the reason is, Einstein is very famous for saying God, by which he meant ultimate reality, does not play dice with the universe. Einstein emphasized he was a determinist. Darwin, on the other hand, said God does play dice with the universe. In his, I think, really most important book, not The Origin of Species, but The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication, in the last chapter, he also talked about God, by which Darwin meant, like Einstein, ultimate reality. He said, in effect, that if you really believe in determinism, if you do not think that chance is ultimate in reality, then you won't think of much of my theory. He was responding to Asa Gray, who thought himself a supporter of Darwin. Asa Gray had argued that, yes, natural selection works on variation, but God provides the variation. When God decides a new species should appear, he provides the variations which are necessary to lead to the new species. Darwin said, nope, this is not the way things are, that evolution proceeds entirely by chance. There is no purpose in evolution. Darwin's view of the evolution of life, Einstein's view of the evolution of not only life, but the entire cosmos, are diametrically opposed. One of them must be wrong. And as you might guess, I, as a indirect lineal intellectual descendant of Albert Einstein, think Einstein is right and Darwin is wrong.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, Dr. Tipler, because I think I would agree with you that Einstein was right. And if I had to choose between Einstein and Darwin, I think I would choose Einstein as well. So let's talk a little bit then about why precisely do you feel that Einstein was right and Darwin was wrong? Would you rather start with Einstein or Darwin?
Well, I've already emphasized what the basic disagreement was. And once again, this is a fundamental disagreement. God does not play dice. God does play dice. Since he is diametrically opposite, only one can be right. I think that Darwin correctly understood his own theory. And I think his intellectual descendants from 1859 to the present have also realized this fundamental chance nature of Darwinian evolution. If there is no chance operating at the most basic level of reality, if evolution is guided, then Darwinian evolution really doesn't make any sense. This does not rule out, of course, common descent. It's just if you have common descent, it has to be guided. Now, we then have to ask, what is the ultimate nature of reality? And that's a question of physics, which is where I come from. Now, Einstein said, God does not play dice, in response to Niels Bohr, my other direction of intellectual descent. But of course, God plays dice. And they were arguing about quantum mechanics. Now, what I discovered is in doing analysis of the central equation of quantum mechanics, which is Schrödinger's equation, that actually Schrödinger's equation is a special case of a classical equation called the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which was actually developed, discovered by Hamilton-Jacobi in the 1840s, something like 20 years before Darwin's publication of Origin of Species. Now, I looked carefully at the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and I realized, remarkably, this has actually been known for decades. The question of mathematics is generally recognized by many different people. Mathematics is mathematics, and if one person doesn't discover a mathematical theorem, someone else will. What I noticed is that the Hamilton-Jacobi equation is actually indeterministic. That is, if you start with the Hamilton-Jacobi equation as a wave equation, like the Schrödinger equation, for what's called the action, and it, so to speak, guides particles. But in certain cases, you can have particle trajectories cross. That corresponds to a cusp in the wave. The equation breaks down. What happens after that is not determined. So classical mechanics, in its most powerful form, recognized as the most powerful expression of classical mechanics, Hamilton-Jacobi theory, is actually indeterministic. So, I said, this can't be right. Let's see if we can make it deterministic. Now, when you have an inconsistency in equations, there's a long history of this problem developing. Maxwell looked at the equations of electricity and magnetism about the time Darwin was writing, publishing Origin of Species. And he said, these equations are inconsistent. Let's add a term. He added a term, and lo and behold, he proved the existence of electromagnetic waves and also that the speed of light was a universal constant, the full implications of which required Albert Einstein to realize. Then Albert Einstein, looking at the equations of gravity, realized you have to add terms to make it fully consistent. Lo and behold, adding terms makes it consistent. So let's look at the Hamilton-Jacobi equation and apply the strategy of Maxwell and Einstein. Let's add a term. Now, the term you add to the Hamilton-Jacobi equation makes it a form of Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It doesn't change its basic nature. Still a Hamilton-Jacobi equation. But this term you add, subject to another equation called a continuity equation, these two equations together are mathematically equivalent to the Schrödinger equation, which, being a linear equation, is fully deterministic. So look at what I've done. I have derived the central equation of quantum mechanics from requiring that determinism holds in classical mechanics. Quantum mechanics, in other words, is classical mechanics with the requirement that God does not play dice. Well, this is a big triumph. Why would people even think that the Schrödinger equation, quantum mechanics, is indeterministic? The reason is the interpretation which everyone gave to the way you function, which is the function that's determined by the Schrödinger equation. Now, Born argued it was a, quote, probability amplitude. All physicists know how to use it mathematically, manipulate it to get experiments. But no physicist since Born really has been happy with that. Physicists feel in their gut that the equations ought to be deterministic. So, how do you solve this? Well, let's see what the wave function really means. What is happening is, remember why we had to introduce this new term? It's because we are having particles come together. As long as another particle just moves on its own, does not encounter the other particles, everything is fine and deterministic. It's when another particle comes in and clobbers the first particle. Well, if another particle clobbers another, if you run into a wall, if your car crashes into another car, that establishes the existence of the wall and the other car. If something clobbers you, that means it exists. That's how we determine something exists. So, it must be that that other particle actually existed before it hit you. So, what we must interpret this wave function as is not a probability amplitude, but as a density of universes in a multiverse of universes. Now, you often hear many worlds interpretation in quantum mechanics, but it's already there in classical mechanics. Physicists of the 19th century just would not take their equation seriously. If they had taken the Hamel-Jacobi equation seriously, we would have had quantum mechanics in the 19th century, because it's an automatic consequence of taking the equation seriously and insisting on determinism. Let's see how that arises in physics. You have these universes, parallel universes. Now remember, I'm talking classical mechanics. I'm talking quantum mechanics. It doesn't matter. The parallel universes exist in both. Well, it has to be, because quantum mechanics is a special case of classical mechanics. But what these equations are telling you is there are an infinite number of parallel universes which are identical to this one. There are an infinite number of yous out there listening to an infinite number of me's saying exactly the same thing. Slightly variance also, but an identical infinity of yous hearing what I'm now saying. Now think, if you're doing an experiment, what you're trying to do is measure, say, in quantum mechanics, the spin of an electron. Spin up or spin down. Let's have it spin in such a way that if you try to measure its spin up, half the time you'll measure spin up and half the time you'll measure its spin down. You can do an electron that way. Now, if you're going to measure that electron's spin, and you're going to do it spin up or spin down, I measure the spin in the vertical direction, then, since there's an infinite number of U's out there which are identical to you, since they're identical, they're going to be doing exactly the same experiment as you. So, what you will see if you carry out a series of measurements is that in half the worlds, the U's will measure spin up. In the other half, the U's will measure spin down. Which one will you measure in this world? That's where it gets interesting. That is a meaningless question to ask, because before the experiment is done, you are absolutely identical to the versions in the other worlds. Absolutely identical. Leibniz taught us identity of indiscernibles. So, it is a meaningless question to ask, meaningless in physics, meaningless in fundamental reality, which one will you measure? It doesn't make any sense to ask that question. Now, in physics, the technical term is not identity of indiscernibles. It's called indistinguishability. That's the technical term we use. And it has consequences besides the one I've just described. For fermions, electrons, an example, indistinguishability causes a repulsive force called an exchange force. Chandrasekhar proved that that force would keep a white dwarf supported, but there would be a limit to its mass, 1.5 solar masses. Experiment confirmed the calculation of Chandrasekhar. 1973, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for this application. Proof of indistinguishability. Then, another type of indistinguishability, Bose-Einstein statistics it's called, has another effect. At low temperatures, you expect the indistinguishability to cause an attractive, so to speak, rather than a repulsive force. This was seen, and another Nobel Prize in physics was given. So, we have to accept indistinguishability. I'm applying it to not only the microstate, but to the macrostate. The universe is deterministic. Einstein got it right. And the only reason physicists have not realized this is they're still resisting interpreting the wave function as a representation of other universes out there. So we conclude that God does not play dice with the universe. So in the end, it's all over for Darwinian evolution theory.
Well, Dr. Tipler, we're running out of time for this podcast, so we're going to pick it up again in another podcast and talk some more about these fascinating topics. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Frank Tipler.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.